Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB 19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!
Our first session this afternoon is called Someone Saved My Life Tonight. And our two presenters are Russ Horowitz and Kian McDermott. Russ is the Director of Emergency and Critical Care Ultrasound at Lurie. Sorry. It's all right. At Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago in USA. And Kian is an adult emergency physician in Dublin. He did spend 4 years in Victoria, Australia until mid-2017 when he moved back. And people might know Kian from his involvement with the organising committee for SMAC. He's been on the organising committee for several of their conferences, Dublin, Berlin and Sydney. And I think it's fair to say that both Russ and Kian are ultrasound geeks. They ran the ultrasound workshop in the pre-conference workshops on Sunday, and they have assured me that they didn't speak to each other this morning about what they were going to wear today. So I'll hand over to them.
Thanks, Susie.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, everybody. We're delighted to be here to speak to you this afternoon about point-of-care ultrasound. And I'm an adult emergency physician, and Russ is a pediatric pediatric emergency physician. And we do share, apart from our choice in clothing today, we do share a love of ultrasound, and we really try to use ultrasound in our everyday practice. Now, we are used to working in a chaotic environment, working with suboptimal information and with limited stories that we are told. We're used to working with big cases, so big children, and so small children and big cases as well. So we're used to that whole spectrum of presentations.
You know, when I think really about ultrasound, what it really does for me and anyone who's an ultrasound practitioner is to sort of say, it doesn't matter what you think the disease is. What it does is it shows you what's deep inside the person's body and reveals to you their true disease.
For me and for us, ultrasound, it's like a superpower. So using ultrasound, I can make decisions faster, better, and smarter. So when a patient gets sick, I need to reevaluate, go back to the bedside, use point of care ultrasound at the bedside. And we're going to take you through a set of cases whereby we look at how ultrasound helps us in everyday practice. So our first case is a 9-month-old baby girl. Her mum brings her into our ED because she has a fever, she's a little bit fussy, and she's vomiting. And mum is worried that she has a urinary tract infection, a UTI. And you are too, so you decide that you need to check her urine. You explain to mum that you're going to place a urinary catheter, and mum turns around to you and says, you know, how can you be so sure? I think my child is dehydrated. How can you be sure that there's actually urine in her bladder? And most of us would have never actually thought about this, and we might have gone ahead and done the procedure. But with ultrasound, we can actually have a look. We can put the probe on, look at the bladder, and have a look and see what truly lies inside. We know that if you have a bladder diameter in the transverse axis like this, if you have a bladder diameter of 2 centimeters or more, you're going to get enough urine returned on your catheter for a culture sample. And our next patient is a 5-year-old girl. She has been puffing on her nebulizers or her home nebulizer for the best part of the night. And she comes into you and she's quite sick. And she's agitated and she's been vomiting. She's really not well, this girl. And you know that you need to do something more than has been done at home. And you're going to need to give her some steroids. And you decide that she's going to need intravenous steroids. Now, all your best people in the department have tried to get a line, and this has just not been successful. And you figure to yourself, what can I do next? Is there a way I can use ultrasound to manage this case? I think it's a perfect opportunity to pop on a linear probe, a high-frequency linear probe, and you can look at the blood vessel right underneath that probe and see what happens as you guide that cannula into the blood vessel. And when you do, this is what you see. You see that blood vessel in the top, in the near field of the screen. It's oval, it collapses, and it's thin walled, so that probably distinguishes it from an artery. And you decide to go ahead and put in the line. And when you do that, You see the needle, that's that bright white spot in the middle of the screen. It tints the top surface of the vein, and in you go. Line is in, IV is sited, and your patient gets their steroids. And for another couple of hours, at least, that patient is now well.
That's a great case, Cian. We had our next patient comes in, and this child's 12 months old, brought in by mom. She was initially seen in the pediatrician's office because the mom was worried she wouldn't walk. She seemed really upset, wouldn't walk. Pediatrician was very concerned about a septic hip joint, sent the child straight away to the emergency department. And based upon the presenting complaint, I too was pretty concerned. And I sort of thought, well, we can look to see with ultrasound if the child has some fluid in that hip joint. So we just take the probe and slide it right up the child's femur, and that'll help us align it appropriately so we can identify that hip joint, except for as we're doing this, we see something that seems a little different. I hadn't even gotten all the way up to the hip joint when we saw this. That bright white line and that break in that line is a fracture in the femur. And so what this made me do was stop, and I said, you know, I had on my list the child had a septic joint, and maybe something like transient synovitis was included in there as well, but this wasn't even something I had thought about. Pediatrician firmly believed the child had a septic joint because of her discomfort, but I think I went along with that belief. And now I see that this is completely different than what my perception was. And in looking at the family and talking to the mom, she seemed very concerned. It didn't occur to me that this mom was bringing in a child who was a victim of non-accidental trauma. Turned out, actually, that it wasn't the mother at all. It wasn't the family. It was the daycare provider. But it reminds me that if I don't look with ultrasound, I don't know. And if I simply go with my perceptions, I'm going to miss some things because it's never even going to raise itself to its surface. Thankfully, this child was removed from the daycare. Things are put in place. She's doing great. The orthopedic surgeons came on, put her in a spike cast, and she's healing great.
Russ, that's a really important case. It's a high-yield one, and you really wouldn't want to miss that, and it shows how ultrasound can help us not miss that. So it's summertime. I know it's hard to believe, and it's this young patient has been running around outside. He's 9 years old, and running around outside in his bare feet, and Dad brings him in because he's pretty sure that something's embedded in the sole of his foot. You do an X-ray, and it's negative for a foreign body. And because we believe that the patient then has cellulitis or an abscess, we say it's a really good idea to put on a high-frequency linear probe. So when we do that, this is what you could see. On the left-hand side, you see fluid that kind of coalesces. It's invaded the soft tissues in a cobblestone sort of pattern, and that's what cellulitis looks like. Or if this progresses, it might look like the next picture, so an abscess. That's fluid in the center of a dark area. It's pus under tension, and if you press it, it'll squish. So that's what an abscess looks like. But we know that if we rely on our clinical judgment, one in four cases, when we try to differentiate an abscess from cellulitis, we're actually wrong. So when we try to tell a cellulitis from an abscess and an abscess from cellulitis, we just don't get this right. And our medical students are no better nor no worse than a more experienced provider. So if you're going to present this case to your surgeon, your in-house specialist, or if you're going to take on a sedation and incise and drain this, that's not a great test if you know you have a 25% fail rate. So instead of seeing these cases, seeing these pictures, what you see instead is this structure embedded in the sole of his foot. It's a foreign body. It's a splinter of wood. It didn't appear on X-ray, but it did appear on ultrasound because we had a look. So using ultrasound in real time, we're able to pluck this foreign body out of his foot. Patient is happy, doesn't need a procedure, in-house procedure, doesn't need an anesthetic, and he goes home with Dad. Everyone is happy.
So that's diagnosis and treatment straight away, huh?
Yeah, real time.
It seems like some days things sort of come in groups or in pairs. So we have some musculoskeletal and soft tissue complaints. Anyone else sort of have that, where it seems like everyone comes in with an abscess, everyone comes in with abdominal pain? We're having a sort of a collection of patients with musculoskeletal and soft tissue complaints today. This 15-year-old girl presents 5 days after falling through a shower door. Shower door shattered. She was seen at an outside emergency department. She had a little leck just right on her leg. They x-rayed it, found no foreign body. It's just a small little laceration, so they repaired it and sent her home. Over the past few days, what's happened, though, is her leg's gotten a little bit more painful right at that site, a little bit red, a little bit tender, and a little bit of discharge. So in talking to her doctor, doctor said, it sounds like you probably have an infection, or maybe there was something that they didn't see. You should come to the emergency department. So she comes to see us, and took a look at it, pretty inflamed and tender. And I figured, oh, you know, we just learned that lesson from our prior case, so we should really take a look with ultrasound, make sure that there's no foreign body in there. But this was right before we transitioned over from one team to the next at our sign out. And I figured this is a pretty straightaway, easy case to deal with. She has an infection, we just pluck those sutures out, open the wound a little bit, express the pus, maybe she needs to get it packed, give her some antibiotics. This is something I could take care of real quickly before the next team arrives. You're smiling because you sort of think whenever you have those thoughts, that's when things go wrong. So we put the ultrasound probe on there and I see this. So she has a pretty large abscess, but thankfully no foreign body, no glass embedded in there. And seems to me, okay, nice. You know, we took a look. That's kind of what I thought anyway. That was sort of the belief of me and her doctor. And we could just clean this out. It was actually like way in the back of the emergency department in that small little room that probably could have been a closet, but they sort of shoved the bed in there. And I just went in with a suture removal kit. I didn't have a pile of gauze or anything. I figured pretty quick and easy. Just told her that's what we're going to do. And on this, we can see a pretty irregular straight abscess. It goes pretty much close to the bottom of the screen. I can't entirely see it. So what I like to do is deepen the depth, get a different probe to make sure there's no small little blood vessel, because if there is, I'd like to be prepared to get some extra gauze. So I deepen the depth, change the probe.
Well, hold on. That's not a small blood vessel. That's a volcano.
And I saw this on the screen. Put the probe down. Took two giant steps back and said, don't move your leg. And then these are sort of the things that even now going forward sort of keep me up at night. Like, what would have happened had I not done that? Well, what would have happened was sort of in a rush to get some other things done, I would have plucked that out, opened this up, and in that back corner room near no one, she would have sprayed femoral arterial blood. And now what I think is, it wasn't even on my differential that this was something that could happen. In retrospect, what must have happened was she fell. She had a small nick in that femoral artery. They held pressure, it stopped, and they sutured it closed. And the pain and discomfort and swelling and discharge she had wasn't an infection. This was the expanding pseudoaneurysm, just waiting for someone else to take those sutures out and make that mistake that I almost made. So from far away, I reminded her, don't move your leg. Gave a call to my vascular surgeon, described the circumstance. They brought her right to the operating room, gave her a femoral graft, and she's doing great.
I think that's an amazing case. Imagine the chaos that would have ensued if you hadn't been able to do that. If you hadn't looked with ultrasound, you just wouldn't have seen the scenario.
Yeah, and it wasn't even something that I had thought about or considered. So it's kind of a busy day in the emergency department. I'm just finishing. I just saved this girl's leg, and the nurse comes in and says that a five-year-old girl in room five, that asthmatic, she's getting worse. You should come and take another look at her. So I go back into the room, and despite the continuous beta-2 agonists we've been giving her and her IV steroids, she's getting worse. Her oxygen level has been dropping. She's consistently wheezing, and she really is short of breath. So she seemed like a typical asthmatic. She's had problems like this before. Mom said, you know, I think she's having a really bad asthma attack. You got to do something. So what do we do when faced with something that seems a little bit different? I re-examine her. I still hear really bad wheezing. And then I'm reminded of the one child that we have in my hospital every single year for the last 10 years who presents with what seemingly was a upper respiratory infection, but actually wasn't that. Those children end up having myocarditis and heart failure. But I listen to her and I hear wheezes. Unfortunately, no matter how good you think your stethoscope is, it's actually pretty useless in distinguishing all those oscillatory lung sounds and isn't good at all in distinguishing things like wheezes from signs of pulmonary edema. I know you're making a frowny face like, are you kidding me? Yeah. But it just tells us that we can't tell. No matter how good you are or how good you think you are, the tool is just not as good as you believe it is. So given that memory, what I do is put the probe on her chest. And we see this.
That does not look good.
And I say, look at her heart. Look at her big, failing heart. Her left ventricle isn't moving at all. Her septal wall and her free wall are not approximating one another at all. Her mitral valve is barely even opening. Her ejection fraction stinks. And I say, but she had wheezes. With an echo like this, I got to look at her lungs, see what we find. Now, normal lungs are boring. We don't really see very much. But what we see on hers is we see all of these bright white lines that emanate from the surface and go all the way down. These are B lines. These are signs of lung water. Her lungs are filled with fluid because of her poorly functioning heart. And I think there were wheezes. She's someone who has a history of wheezes. I mean, this just isn't fair. This should be easier to take care of something that we run across all the time, a regular asthmatic. So faced with this, we say, okay, we're going to have to get her taken care of, get her admitted to the critical care cardiologist. I give them a call, and I start describing her scenario.
I'm going to stop you there, Russ. I'm going to pause that case, and I want you to think back of a time, not all that long ago, of a time when this fantastic ultrasound technology was just not available for us. So what would have happened with this five-year-old, this young girl with asthma, worsening asthma? Well, the chances are she probably would have been admitted from the ED to the ward.
Sure.
And as the night went on, she would have got worse. Her respiratory status would have deteriorated. And, you know, it sometimes happens as patients get sicker overnight, they get fluids. And if she got fluids, that would have pushed her right up to the edge, right over the edge, and she would have fallen off the edge of that Starling curve. And we would have thought all along that she had a case of a really severe, an acute severe asthma exacerbation. We would never have known the truth had we not used ultrasound. We just would have never known the truth. For us, ultrasound, it leads you down the correct path. Using ultrasound, we can take care of our small patients in big ways, and we can treat big cases and small cases.
You know, ultrasound doesn't really care what your beliefs are, what you think the disease is. It doesn't matter how accurate your physical exam skills are, and it doesn't really give a damn about what you have thought should be included on the differential diagnosis. It simply looks below the surface and sees the true disease. Really, in our goal of finding truth and fact, all what one must do is place the probe, look beneath the surface, and see the true disease.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kian and Russ. I'm going to ask Jane what's come through on Twitter, and I'll take questions from the floor. What we're going to do with questions from the floor is, if you ask the question in a loud voice, I'll get Kian or Russ to repeat the question and then answer it, so we won't have to run back and forth with the mic too much. But just to get things kicked off, the question I wanted to ask was, if I'm someone who's never used ultrasound, so have no training, no skills, how do I start? What do I need to do to learn how to use ultrasound?
You want to take this, Kian?
Yeah. I think a great starting place is vascular access. So we ran our workshop on Sunday, and we built lots of really fun models, so task trainers. We have some expensive ones from the well-known companies that have embedded branched chain pieces that you can actually place a needle into, and they can aspirate blood. Or you can make homemade task trainers. We had a piece of tofu with pieces of wood embedded in it, so that you can simulate those tasks. I think vascular access is a really good starting point because it builds a lot of motor skills that you can use in lots of other cases. And you do need to think about accreditation and credentialing, but I think vascular access is something you could start off, and it might not necessarily need to be medical staff, it could be your nursing staff as well. So a lot of people can share that skill.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the floor? I'll hand over to Jane for a sec.
Thanks. So there's two parts to this from Hannah Sundqvist. The first one is, do your departments have standardized process for saving, reporting, documenting your scan results?
Yes. So what we have is all of our images get saved on our ultrasound machine, and there's a number of different ways that one can do this. There is usually someone in charge, the ultrasound director, who will review those images, provide feedback to those practitioners. That's what we do for most of the things we do. In the emergency department, in terms of patients who return after care or patients who go to the intensive care unit. So that becomes part of our traditional care to review those images. In addition, there's a bunch of different ways that one can store those on the machine, cloud servers, or distribute those to even people who aren't at your facility and review those, provide feedback. Depending upon where you work, those either get embedded into the chart from an electronic medical record or it can exist in a third-party cloud-based software.
Thanks. And secondly, do your patients all progress to any to formal ultrasounds as well? And she comments, I seem to have problems convincing my inpatient colleagues without one.
So the question is, do we always progress to... I don't like the term formal, because what I think what we do is pretty formal. I kind of talk about it in terms of educational and comprehensive, because what we do is point of care study, and there is a difference. So I never am aspiring to be, you know, a radiologist that does these. This is not, I do other things as well. So I do, I ask a very binary focused question and I generate a straightforward answer. So I think this is a rule in test rather than a rule out test. So in most cases, especially when you're getting your program off the ground, yes, it should be followed by a comprehensive study. Sorry, thank you.
And I can add on to that a little bit. It depends upon what sort of your goals are. Now, in certain circumstances, let's say like appendicitis. I'm not the one wielding the knife, so I won't cut that child open. And the surgeons are going to require perhaps a lot more information about the details of the appendix and exactly where it lives, and the radiologist can provide that. But what these studies allow me to do is, I know as the medical provider that there are things that I do when we find someone who's diagnosed with appendicitis. That's on the medical side. So I provide the patient with antibiotics. I inform him or her and the family that the child, what the disease is, appendicitis. We get the patient booked for a bed. We start moving the process. Because the faster that we can get the person diagnosed, the quicker they can move out of the cesspool of disease that is the emergency department and up to the floor where they're going to get their appropriate care. And if we go through the process of only using the resources available from radiology, then I simply have to wait to see what happens before I can start to put in those antibiotics in that bed space. But if I diagnose the disease, then yes, I understand that they're going to need their complete study, and that provides a lot of information for them. But once I make that diagnosis, we can get that person diagnosed straight away. I can tell the family what you're going to expect. Let's think about all the things that have to happen. Someone's going to have to get childcare for other children. Someone has to arrange to be out from work for a day or two. And we can get that patient antibiotics, consult to the surgeon, and if in the right scenario aligns, this happens right toward the end of the day, the child's been NPO for a number of hours, maybe that child becomes the add-on case. Goes home an entire day earlier.
Are there any moves to formalize training in POCUS at the moment, like FICE in ITU? Oh,
good question.
Sorry, that was from NAPT and Norwich PEM.
That's an interesting question because we have a WhatsApp group amongst a group of us in Ireland and the UK, and the situation on this side of the Atlantic is slightly different. You've been in North America, been fortunate to have a credentialing process in place for at least 15 years through ACEP, through your national body. So it's slightly different here. What you mentioned is FICE, and one of our instructors at the faculty at the course on Sunday has started a course called CACTUS, which is a similar process whereby you can establish a logbook and find a mentor and a supervisor that will sign you off in certain regards and allow you then to practice with supervision but more independently to see that you're safe. FICE and CUSIC have become merged now to be called FUSIC. So you find a lot of these kind of acronyms, 4, 5, 6-letter acronyms in ultrasound world. But that process is getting up off the ground. It takes time. It takes people to do that. It takes lots of, it just takes sweat equity, I think. You guys have covered that ground in North America. Yep. We're covering it in Ireland and the UK at the moment. So, yes.
And to give a little bit of how it sort of evolved, what ended up happening in general emergency medicine training in the US, now it's part of all the things that the residents have to learn, just like intubation and EKG and all their other skills. So it's part of their training. They sign off and gather their list of procedures, their list of scans. And then when they graduate, it means, yes, check. You've completed all this stuff. You're allowed to intubate patients. You can do ultrasound. You can interpret EKGs. And it's just part of the core group of requirements that people are taught. So I think that's the way things are going. And at first now, what it ends up being is that it's a separate thing. But in time, it just becomes part of what people do.
Okay, we've got time for one more question. Anything from the floor? Can you shout it out, and I'll get these guys to repeat it.
I'll take it. Oh, yeah.
So the first question was top tips for trying to manage squirmy children. Yeah, with that for vascular access. And the second bit?
In the 5-year-old case, did you guys manage to get an X-ray if that was unresponsive asthma treatment? Or did you guys actually scan first?
Do you want to do the... I can do your case at the end. So in the cardiology case...
Just repeat the question.
Sorry. In the cardiology case, the question was... The asthmatic, excuse me, did you do the X-ray first or at all? Or did you just look at the heart? When I went to re-examine the person, I had the question in my mind, could this be something worse? So because it becomes part of my practice to re-examine patients when there's a change in clinical status, I brought the ultrasound probe in. I did the X-ray because I know that that's what the other specialists require and use. We did an EKG, we did a bunch of other things, but not unlike the case that I described with appendicitis, I now saw what was happening. I did the other things because I know that that's useful for the critical care folks. But what this did is it got the girl to the right place pretty quickly. Often I can describe something to a cardiologist or intensivist and say, this is what I've found. In this particular case, they said, you know what? Bring her upstairs. We'll do a complete echo for her upstairs. But it seems like she really needs to be out of the emergency department in a critical care environment. So that lessened the amount of workload for all the people who are in the emergency department, cleared her out to the right spot. We were able to move some more patients in. And vascular access for little people?
Yeah, I think you're probably better suited to talk about top tips. But one thing I did want to share in our workshop on Sunday, some of the models, and they're kind of invested because they're your children and Tessa's children. They were sitting there. One guy was reading out from his Kindle. He was reading out a passage from a book that he had been reading the night before. So I think a lot of distraction techniques help. A phone helps. Lights help. Things that are commonly used in other settings. What do you use, Russ?
All those things, those distractions are wonderful. And I think everyone now has a phone, so we use that for most kids. We use some topical anesthetic so that the initial poke is not so uncomfortable for the children. And not unlike when we're doing vascular access for any child, you really need a lot of assistance. So there's usually someone who's going to be hooked up to the syringe to draw the blood back, someone else holding the child's arm. We even have some child life specialists. All those things are useful. I think if you learn on children, then your initial learning curve is a little bit steeper. But for us, once you've done it on a squirming child, someone who sits still is pretty easy.
I suppose if all else fails, you can always bribe them with ice cream or chocolate.
As long as they don't have appendicitis.
Yeah, sure.
Thanks.
All right. I think we've got to call it time there. Thank you very much, Kian and Russ.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!